At this point in the speech, Disraeli, with incredible audacity, proceeded to argue that even for the Tories, Jews should be welcomed into Parliament because an embrace of the Jewish people would not undo their support for Christianity, because, Disraeli argued, a Christian country needed to recognize the debt it owed the Jews. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 148, Young Disraeli in Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In the 1630s, Jerusalem was visited by a young man who, like Moses Montefiore, had been born into the Sephardic Jewish community. But his own upbringing was very different from that of the famous philanthropist. This young man's name was Benjamin Disraeli, and the visit to Jerusalem would impact his public persona for the rest of his life. As I've discussed in my Tikva lectures on Jewish statesmanship, one of the most striking aspects of Benjamin Disraeli's life is how it embodies, in a certain respect, a reversal of that of his father. Isaac Disraeli was born in 1766, and he would grow up with terribly negative feelings toward the history of his family's faith. Isaac became a writer of some note, but first made his views about Judaism publicly known when he was invited to become Parnas, a president or trustee of the Bevis Marks Synagogue, to this day the oldest synagogue in England. Isaac Disraeli refused, and the policy of the community was that those that refused the offer of serving the synagogue in leadership had to pay a fine. Isaac Disraeli separated himself from the community and explained, effectively, that he disliked attending the house of worship, telling the community that he could, quote, never unite in your public worship because, as now conducted, it disturbs instead of exciting religious emotions, a circumstance of general acknowledgement, who has only tolerated some part of your ritual, end quote. Several years later, in 1817, he decided to have his four children brought to church and be baptized, including Benjamin Disraeli, 12 years old, 6 months before his bar mitzvah. Yet strikingly, in contrast to his father, even as Benjamin never spent his adult life within the Jewish community, he, Benjamin, would always make manifest a pride in how profoundly Judaism had impacted the world. Benjamin Disraeli was sent to school, dabbled in law and journalism, and then became a novelist. In 1830, he set out for the East, coming ultimately to Jerusalem. As he later reported, and this is cited by Montefiore, Disraeli's experience upon seeing the city was one that would leave a lasting impression. Disraeli wrote, quote, I was thunderstruck. I saw before me apparently a gorgeous city. In the front is a magnificent mosque built on the site of the temple with its beautiful garden and fantastic gates. A variety of domes and towers arise. Nothing could be conceived more wild and terrible and barren than the surrounding scenery. I never saw anything more essentially striking. End quote. There, in the area of Jerusalem, as Simon Sebag Montefiore further reports, Disraeli began working on a novel about a Jewish messianic figure, and in the novel, this figure's advisor says, quote, you ask me what I wish. My answer is a national existence. You ask what I wish. My answer is Jerusalem. End quote. It is very clear that Disraeli, for much of his life, would ponder the fact, the fascinating fact, that the small people that was biblical Israel living in a small sliver of land that was Eretz Israel changed the world. And yet, despite this enormous impact on the world, many of those impacted by this people nevertheless persecuted this people's descendants in his day. This, Disraeli believed, was a terrible contradiction, one on which he would reflect later in his novel Tancred. In this novel, describing the experience of traveling to the sacred city, Disraeli writes, quote, passing over groups and masses of houses built of stone with terraced roofs or surmounted with small domes, we reach the hill of Salem, where Melchizedek built his mystic citadel, and still remains the hill of Scopus, where Titus gazed upon Jerusalem on the eve of his final assault. Titus destroyed the temple. The religion of Judea has in turn subverted the fanes which were raised to his father and to himself in their imperial capital. And the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob is now worshipped before every altar in Rome. End quote. This theme of the Jewish people's impact on the world and of the unjust persecution of the Jewish people made itself manifest in one of the most fascinating moments of Disraeli's early political life. In 1847, one of the most prominent Jews in England, Lionel Rothschild, was elected to Parliament, but was unable to take his seat as the required oath had to be said based on one's quote-unquote faith as a Christian. This was, of course, not an impediment to Disraeli himself, thanks to his baptism. In response to the inability of Lionel Rothschild to take the required oath, the Prime Minister of the Whig Party, which was then in control of the government, Lord John Russell, brought a bill to the floor known as the Jewish Disabilities Act, which referred to a bill to remove any restrictions on Jews entering Parliament. In an impassioned and admirable speech opening the debate, Lord Russell argued that Jews, like anyone else, should be allowed into Parliament in the name of religious freedom. Though largely supported by Russell's party, the law was opposed by the Tories, the party of Benjamin Disraeli. The Tories largely argued that amending the oath and allowing Jews into the governing body of the country would dilute Britain's Christian character. But as the debate came to a close, one Tory rose to his feet and, in opposition to his own party, argued that Jews should be let in, not merely in the name of religious freedom, but due to all that the Christian world owed the Jews. This is an astonishing thing to say in mid-19th century England, and the case was made by the young MP, Benjamin Disraeli. And I'm indebted, in this episode, to the excellent book on Disraeli by Adam Kirsch, who focuses on Disraeli's life in general and on this moment in Disraeli's career in particular. Disraeli said, referring to Lord Russell, quote, "I observe that the noble lord who introduced this question to our consideration tonight introduced it to our consideration as a question of principle. I have just heard the right honorable gentleman, the member for the University of Cambridge, Mr. Goulburn, oppose that proposition in a very able speech, and he grounded that opposition also on the assertion that it is a question of principle. The principle of the noble lord is the principle of religious liberty. The principle of the right honorable gentleman is, I apprehend, the principle of religious truth," end quote. In other words, what Disraeli was saying was that Lord John Russell was focusing on religious freedom as the reason to allow Jews into Parliament, while the Tories insisted that the obligation of the English Parliament was to uphold Christianity. At this point in the speech, Disraeli, with incredible audacity, proceeded to argue that even for the Tories, Jews should be welcomed into Parliament because an embrace of the Jewish people would not undo their support for Christianity. Because, Disraeli argued, a Christian country needed to recognize the debt it owed the Jews. Disraeli said, quote, "Has not the Church of Christ, the Christian Church, whether Roman Catholic or Protestant, made the history of the Jews the most celebrated history in the world? On every sacred day you read to the people the exploits of Jewish heroes, the proofs of Jewish devotion, the brilliant annals of past Jewish magnificence. The Christian Church has covered every kingdom with sacred buildings and over every altar, as we were properly reminded by the honorable member for Oldham, we find the tables of the Jewish law." And then he added a bit later in the speech, "I am prepared to lay down the broadest principles as to the importance of maintaining a Christian character in this house and in this country. And yet it is on this very ground you will found and find the best argument for the admission of the Jews," end quote. And then he added the utterly unexpected statement, utterly unlike any other argument put forward in Parliament that day, saying, quote, "The very reason for admitting the Jews is because they can show so near an affinity to you. Where is your Christianity if you do not believe in their Judaism?" End quote. According to those who were there, the response was scorn and boos from fellow members of his party. The measure passed due to Whig support, with almost the entire Tory party opposing, and it was then squelched for around a decade by Tories in the House of Lords. Benjamin Disraeli's party was entirely opposed to his argument, and his speech stands to this day as a striking example of a position taken by Disraeli that was, it would seem, not in his political self-interest, but founded on some deeply held belief. In this speech, we see, I think, the impact of the original visit to Jerusalem. And as I argued in my Tikva lecture, pondering this story, as well as the fact that a man who gave a speech like this ultimately became prime minister, we are able to discern two different themes regarding the Jews in British history. There is the story of anti-Semitism. In England, the blood libel was born. In England emerged the literary archetype of Shylock, which then lived on in other stereotypes in literature. But there is also the aspect of England documented by the historian Gertrude Himmelfarb in her book, The People of the Book, Philo-Semitism in England from Cromwell to Churchill. Himmelfarb shows us the Philo-Semitic side of England, which made itself manifest in Cromwell's openness to Menashe ben Israel and in novels such as Ivanhoe and Daniel Deronda. And yes, in the fact that a man who spoke and wrote about the impact of the Jewish people on the world, as Disraeli did, could be elected as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Disraeli would experience anti-Semitism, but also cultivate Philo-Semitism. And we will see this Philo-Semitic stream of England in Disraeli's contemporary, the Earl of Shaftesbury, another subject in Himmelfarb's book, whose own dream of the Jewish return to the Holy Land will herald the support of Lloyd George for the Balfour Declaration. One of the quotes with which Simon Sebag Montefiore's book about Jerusalem begins is from Disraeli, who wrote, "The view of Jerusalem is the history of the world. It is more, it is the history of earth and of heaven. This insight of Disraeli's lies at the heart of much of his own thinking about the Jewish people, and it lies at the heart of the story of the city that we are studying together. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.